One thing I was told was to give free consultations, for example. And so I could be lawyerish and not feel bad because I'm charging you for it. After a while, I realized that I could turn that into a product with a deliverable, right? Seth Godin has this thing where he says, charge as much as you have to keep the promises that you made.
Coming to you from the deep and weird and ADHD-fueled recesses of Marshall Lichty's neocortex, this is JDHD, a podcast for lawyers with ADHD where we talk about, finally, getting stuff done. We help you optimize your law practice, your business, your life, and your brain. We hyper-focus on ideas, tips, and tricks for every lawyer with ADHD, whether they know they have it or not. And now, your host, a guy who once held someone's fake eyeball in his palm, Marshall Lichty.
Good morning, everybody out there. This is Marshall Lichty, and I'm a lawyer. I've got ADHD. Hey, thank you so much for tuning into the JDHD podcast. We are, as you might have figured, a podcast for lawyers with ADHD. And I got to tell you, today's episode gets me really excited, partly because we talk a lot about shame and vulnerability and support. I'm struggling right now because it's been a couple of weeks since I've released an episode, and I had set these expectations for myself, and I have been unrelenting on myself. And hearing from our guest today was really helpful in just what I needed in getting this one up and going. Meanwhile, I actually hired a new podcast producer. Hey, Carmelo, it's awesome to have you aboard. Thank you. I'm also going to Podfest in Orlando on Thursday. So this week, right at the end of the week, I'm headed down to Disney World or its vicinity anyway to talk with a bunch of people in the podcasting universe about how to become better at this. And so I'm really excited about that. I am really excited about stuff. Things are moving really well, and we're going to dive into this episode in a second because it's really important. And my guest today, a guy named Mike Whalen, who has a vast experience in the lawyering world, especially for small and solos. He is an author of a book called Lawyer Forward, and he is everywhere on Twitter, fresh off of his trip to ABA Tech Show last week. This is a great episode, and I'm really looking forward to it. Before we dive in, I want to say one more thing. I had a very proud moment on Friday night. My wife, who is a bona fide badass rock star and a lawyer at a really good-sized company in town, hosted her team at our house for dinner on Friday night. And when I thought about it, it occurred to me that I was surrounded by a table full of professional women who brought their spouses to a work event. And all of those spouses were men. And I have never been in a place where it was all women, all professionals who brought their plus ones, and it was the men who were the tag-alongs. And I loved that feeling, and I'm so proud of her, and I'm proud of her team, and I'm proud of her company for doing things the way that they do. I love you, babe. Meanwhile, I also love Mike Whalen, and that's who we're going to talk to. Well, Mike, I got to tell you, thanks for coming on JDHD, man. Welcome.
I am happy to be here and hang out with you. I am in my closet studio with blankets hanging over me because that's what professional podcasters do.
Well, you sound amazing as usual. And what's funny to me is we've done this before, but frankly, I know you best as a prolific member of the Twitterati. And so I feel like I know you in short, pithy, lovely sound bites rather than long form interview stuff. So I'm really excited to dive in with you.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter a lot because I cannot afford a therapist. So I put it there so that I don't have to go pay for somebody. I'm sorry, world. Okay. I'm just working through some stuff, but happy to do it out loud with you guys on Twitter.
I love it. It's amazing. Well, maybe Twitter is a good segue to impulse control, which is maybe a good segue into ADHD and what I call JDHDs. My understanding is that you are one. You're a JDHD.
I was, in fact, diagnosed during law school, which is a whole story, but yes.
So I'm fascinated by that. We're going to get to law school in a second. But first, what did it feel like growing up with undiagnosed ADD?
It felt like I got in trouble a lot. Mm-hmm. My mom, we were at a family reunion recently, and my mom was telling my wife about my third grade teacher just called my mom in one day and said, "Your son will not stop talking." She was really emphatic about it. Like, this was, no matter what was going on in the classroom, I had a joke, I had a comment. And And it's interesting because the joking became kind of a coping mechanism. And as I grew up, I didn't really realize that, right? I just thought it was hilarious. And of course, being hilarious comes with the negativity, right? It's the feeling that you're supposed to be funny all the time. And so, you know, half the time I was saying something funny and I took that praise, and half the time I was saying something totally offensive and stupid, and I really internalized that negativity. So, you know, growing up, I had this feeling that was constantly with me that I could not achieve. I remember talking to one of my friends who I stayed in touch with on Facebook, who was one of my high school friends, and I made a joke about the fact that I hung around with all these overachievers and felt really out of place. And he said to me, "Mike, you were one of the most overachieving people in our group. You just didn't play the part." And thinking about, you know, the stuff that I accomplished in high school, but all the negativity that came with it, because I felt like I couldn't be on all the time. I was constantly judging. One of the most constant companions that I've found of my ADHD, especially when it was undiagnosed, was this feeling of just not being qualified, right? Just the shame of feeling like I was not an overachiever, that I could not achieve. And that was probably the largest negative association I had with it growing up.
Yeah. And I, you know, we hear a lot of people talk about imposter syndrome. And what I hear from you, and certainly my experience too, is this isn't just imposter syndrome. This is imposter syndrome. Like, you know, did you ever watch Despicable Me, where they got shot up with the stuff and they turned purple and into monsters? This is like imposter syndrome with the purple monster Despicable Me thing, where you're just like the shame. It's not just maybe I don't belong here. It's like I don't belong here. And everything that I've done leading up to this moment is like shameful. If I just would have done something differently, maybe I would belong here, but I don't.
Right. And, you know, I've written a lot about shame as a concept, and I've written about it in sort of a different context, thinking about what somebody wants when they're getting divorced, for example. We've talked a lot in law about what they actually want is just some finished process. But in fact, most of the time what I found is that someone wants to publicly shame the other someone. There's some emotional need that I think is deeper than a process. And the reason is that anthropologically, we've always used shame, right? Shame is one of the major trainers of the next generation and how they're supposed to behave, how they fit in, what the expectations and roles are that are assigned to different people. So shame is a social mechanism that we're really hardwired with. And you and I assume growing up, that shame was purposely put on us, right? Because the behavior that is most destructive in a school environment is standing out. It's not standing in line. It's making noise when you're not supposed to. And so the shame that became associated with standing out in any way was so heavy that it became just part of my identity. Like you said, it was doped up imposter syndrome. It was a whole system was created to make me feel that shame, and I was happy to comply with feeling.
Yeah. So I want to get back to that, but before I do, tell me about your diagnosis story. How did you come to a point where you went out and did the things necessary to get diagnosed with ADHD?
So I went to law school when I was 30, and I had 4 kids in tow at the time, and would not recommend that to anyone. But, you know, it sort of reflected my inability to commit to a track. I had, you know, after I went on my mission for 2 years, an LDS mission in Italy, I came back, I went to, I worked in a trucking company. I worked at another
supply chain management. Yeah.
Right. I was doing logistics and dispatch and different things. And then I moved over to undergrad, and I went out there thinking I was going to go to dental school. And then I found out that you like have to touch people. And I was not okay with that. And there were needles involved. It was not cool. So I switched to Middle East studies, obviously, because that's an obvious pivot from pre-dental.
Obviously.
And then my wife was really concerned. I had been accepted to a PhD program. My wife was really concerned that I wanted to be in school for the rest of my life.
Sure.
School has this very cool thing that every semester you get to play in a totally different area, right? You get to set up your classes and it can be something totally different. And the fact that I went from dental to Middle East studies to linguistics to history, not only can you change your class setup, you can change your major. So for a brain like mine, to be able to just bounce around on subjects and play and
then hyper-focus.
and then hyper-focus. And, you know, when I did it, I was pretty damn good at each thing, yep. which sucks, right? That's a that so far being really, you know, pretty good at a lot of things and not great at something is a really hard state to be in. So my wife was like, I don't want you to go to school for the rest of forever. We left. I didn't do the PhD program. And eventually I convinced her we should go to law school. It is the best financial bet. So
this has got to be what, 2006 or something?
No, I went into law school in September of 08 and it was October of 08 when the banks collapsed. So we were literally the last people that didn't know. And when I went to law school, something that was new was I wasn't a genius anymore, right?
Yep.
My ability to just screw around and pull it off at the end, I'm now just normal, right? In law school, I went to Texas. And Texas is an interesting school. It's not in the Yale or Harvard bracket, but it's like in the 12 to 15, whatever range. And so, you know, they're trust fund babies, right? They're kids who've been successful their whole lives.
You bet.
They're studying for 14 hours a day, this stuff. And we're on a curve. And I'm freaking out, right? I can't keep up. I've got a wife and kids at home. They've got demands. And so I went and sought a diagnosis. And I got to tell you, it was disturbingly easy to get that diagnosis.
Interesting. My experience with getting diagnosed was different, but the lead up, the sort of awareness of, you know, your intellectual frailty maybe, or, you know, all of a sudden being level set when you come into a group of people who maybe have some intellectual ability, but also have a longstanding work ethic and ability to dive deep into all kinds of subjects, regardless of whether there's a trigger to force them to do it. I mean, that's right. Been one of my experiences with my ADHD is I can do just about anything as long as I have, you know, the equivalent of a, you know, a death threat. If you don't do this, something horrible is going to happen. I'm like, oh, great. I can knock that out. I will knock it out all night long or two nights in a row if we need to. Right. And so, yeah, that's consistent with my experience too. But tell me, even in law school, when you were getting diagnosed, you were still doing the things that I associate with the superpowers of ADHD. So you were entrepreneurial even back then. You started the future small and solo firm attorney group, building community and things like that. You were also relational and meeting lawyers in and out of the practice areas that you were goofing around with. Tell me one thing that I'm really interested in, and I kind of want to transition into a little bit, is you are the quintessential builder of communities, and you have some history with it, but I think primarily you do it through vulnerability. And so I want to bridge from your experience at Texas and that entrepreneurialism and building a future small and solo firm group. And I want you to tell me about how that vulnerability and building that community first showed itself. And in particular, I would love for you to tell me about Texas wildfires.
Yeah. So it's funny. My former law partner used to make fun of me for telling the wildfire story because I was cashing in on it years later. So yeah, briefly, I went to Texas and as an aside, part of the reason that the ADHD was so easy to diagnose is because we were broke at the time. And we had, I think the kids were on CHIP and my wife and I were cash pay. And so we went to a clinic and were paying very little, filled out a questionnaire, and they gave me medication right away for ADHD, which, you know, that gets to the whole social issue of how quick a trigger we have to diagnose poorer kids with ADHD.
Yes.
When it may in fact be all kinds of other social problems, but that poverty, that environment that we were in law school in poverty, set us up so that our buffer, our ability to take a negative, was not high. And right after I graduated law school, knowing I was going to go solo, I knew that from the beginning, which is why I started that club at UT. I went and I took the bar exam in whatever it is, July or August or whatever it is.
Yep.
And then in September on Labor Day, there were a series of wildfires in Texas, and ours was one of the houses that burnt down. And we
literally burned down. Your house burned all the way to the ground.
Fully to the ground. There is a YouTube video. If you search Leander, which is just like leader with an N after the A, if you search Leander wildfire on YouTube, you can see a helicopter flying over these houses on fire. And what's weird is Bastrop, which is southeast of Austin, was completely wiped out, right? Bastrop was where it was really bad. We were in the northwest in Leander, And so there were only 20, I think, houses in our area, but ours was the first. You can see on that video on YouTube, our house is the one in the middle that is completely gone. And it was completely gone. Very surreal. Gosh. Yeah, it was surreal. And it was an interesting experience. I wrote an article about it on my shingle, or I'm sorry, on Solo Practice University afterwards that you can find. And I think what you're referencing in that article that was interesting was when the fire happened, when you've got ADHD and you've got this shame particularly associated and the insecurity of your networks. I was watching a video from the Mayo Clinic where they were talking about some of the results of adult ADHD, that you don't have the hyperactivity as much, but one of the things that you've really trained yourself on is that shame associated with doing something wrong. So a lot of times you'll have a really good hour, but in that last 5 minutes, you'll have something said to you that you take so harshly that all the rest of it is negative, right? Like you see that whole hour is negative.
Yep.
And you'll spend the next hour recycling it in your head. The wildfire was sort of like that for me in the sense that I felt very alone, and it was a pretty brutal bit of timing, right? I'm waiting for the bar exam results and we're about to start our own firm. But I had put out to the world that my wife had her mom's wedding ring. Her mom had just died. My wife had her mom's wedding ring and her mom's ashes were in an urn, and she needed these two things, right? The house is completely leveled. There's nothing. And my wife needed these two things.
Where this is headed, it feels like, is the old maxim, build a community, build a network, build a group long before you have it. Because in the moment, it's not time for you to go out and say, who are we going to ask to help us? Right.
Right.
So yeah, now so we've got the treasure hunt for a ring and an urn.
Yeah. And I put it out to the world and just on Facebook, right? I hadn't been in the Twitter community much at that point, but on Facebook, I put out, hey, I need some help finding these things. And we had, about 50 people show up, some of whom I had never met before. My sister's roommate from college in Utah, we live in Austin at this time. My sister's roommate from college in Utah, her brother shows up, right? This is how tangential it is. But one group that really surprised me was there were several practicing lawyers who showed up who I had never really talked to much, and ended up being close friends. In the end, what that showed me was that networking, what we call networking, is a very human activity. It's not as mathematical as we like to believe it is.
Yes.
And that social capital that you can build up by minding those networks fills in for a lot of the gaps that we perceive in our own ability to get things done, right? So you mentioned some of the ADHD superpowers. And I have some of those, but I also have the stark negatives of ADHD, and the network was what helped plug in for those negatives.
So I want to talk a little bit more about that, because you've talked about building community, and you've talked about how to build the support around you and build communities around you. And some of the recommendations or examples that you lived are to join communities, to create communities, which you've done plenty of that. And also, you use this phrase of living out loud. And that's what's most inspiring to me. It's really why I'm so excited to have you here, is to talk about how being vulnerable by living out loud can break down some of those barriers, which is what builds an emotional connection, which builds a real relationship, which is what actually leads to additive parts of our world. It's not networking. It's not handing out a business card at a thing. It's actually going out and building community through vulnerability and connection. And so what I'd love to hear you talk at least a little bit more about is, how does that living out loud that you've done, sharing on Twitter and in blogging and on podcasts all about struggles that you've had and insecurities that you have and vulnerabilities you have and shame that you have, how does that turn into a superpower?
Yeah, social capital is a complicated thing, especially because we believe so many things about it that are not actually true. One of the things that has driven me through my legal career is the fact that I did work in the supply chain before I went to law school. And I don't want to get too nerdy on this, because it sounds very nerdy and technical, but it's actually very human. Very briefly, the supply chain is basically you go to Walmart to pick up a doll. There's no guy there who calls the dude in China at the factory, and Walmart owns that factory, and Walmart owns the truck that takes it to the boat, and the boat that takes it to the train, and the train that takes it to another truck to the warehouse. That's not how it works. The way the supply chain works is all those people are connected with one common goal, but they're each specializing in their bit. And the argument that I make in this book
can
that's coming...
Can I stop you? Because I want to just briefly... One way to think about the supply chain for you lawyers out there is it's a lot like the chain of custody or the chain of evidence. Supply chain, there's a whole lot of work that goes into making sure that a piece of evidence gets from the crime scene to the courtroom in an unadulterated way. And the same is true for supply chain. So there are professionals out there, many of them, and Mike was one, who are in the business of maximizing the productivity and the efficiency of the supply chain to get the doll to Walmart. So there are a lot of best practices that go into that. And I think what you were going to say is that's been useful to you in talking about law and coaching lawyers in how to make better law businesses.
Yeah. And because it's such an inherently social thing, there's a book called Sapiens, which got pretty popular. And basically that author, Yuval Noah Harari, I think is his name.
I think that's right.
He makes the argument that every human advancement and what makes humans special is their ability to collaborate. It is the connection. And I tell the story all the time. There was a PhD in design, I think, in the UK, who decided he went to a store and there was a $5 toaster. He decided he would make that thing from scratch. And the short version is, you know, it was an artisan toaster. He was doing it all by himself. And it cost $2,300 and didn't work by the end, right? When he plugged it in, it literally melted. Everything about the thing melted. But he uses that to illustrate the power of those connections is not, we think it's a negative. We think relying on other people, connecting with other people is a negative. The issue that is true in supply chain and it's true in social capital, it's true in our firms, is how we foster those connections, how we unite our goals, right? That's a requirement. How we design our silos, right? Our closed social networks, making sure it's diverse, making sure we have different ways of thinking, that it's supportive, but also challenging. But then that we connect with other communities and our individual community, there's ways in and out of it. That science that we can reduce to getting a doll to my daughter in suburban Kansas City from China, it's just an analogy for a very human activity. And so what I've argued forever, it feels like, is that being yourself loudly and showing that vulnerability and putting yourself out in the world, it actually creates opportunities for connection that are a net positive for you, for the people you serve, and for society at large. That's been proven through human history.
I wrote down a quote from a blog that you wrote. If you'll open up your experience to others, you'll find a tribe of friends who want to support you. And I think for me, that's really the thread here. It's when you are open and willing to share not just the things that look good on Facebook, but also the things that are difficult or brutal or uncomfortable, that's when we have shared moments. And it's those shared moments that allow people to connect with us and recognize our needs and our strengths and find when we need support, find when we need to go find mom's wedding ring in the ashes, literally. And it's one of the things that I think is a power that you bring to the world. And I don't just mean legal tech Twitter, and I don't just mean in the speeches that you give around the country, but also in sort of just the way that you approach the world and the words that you say and the sharing that you do. And so I first and foremost want to say thank you. You know, Kat Moon says that we need to be out there amplifying the people who inspire us. And you are one of those people for me, Mike. And like I said, I'm really thankful that you're here. I'm going to give a quick little shout because I can't do this enough. You can find Mike at Mike Whalen Jr. at Twitter. And he's prolific there. And from there, you can connect to him in a bunch of different ways, including the book that he's about to write. And if you want to get updates on his book, you can go to lawyerforward.com/book updates and sign up for his list. Because he's writing a book. Before we get to that book that is almost done, we're going to talk a little bit more about it. But I want to talk about your magnificent ability to be a prolific content creator. You've created content in blogs. You've created content on podcasts. You're writing a book. You are the managing editor of a legal tech company called Case Text. And you've managed in-person events and you're a coach and you've done just a prolific amount of work, essentially becoming a coach for lawyers. And I want to hear a little bit more about how your content creation is colored by your ADHD. If you can spend just a minute kind of talking about where it's a strength and some of the places where maybe it isn't.
Right. Side note, there's a book called The Business of Expertise by David C. Baker that I quote a lot. And in that book, he has a process that he refers to as getting to know, K-N-O-W, getting to know. And the idea is if you decide to make the effort to become a known expert about something, right? You want the world to see you as somebody who knows your stuff. It's easy on the front end of that to feel like that's impossible. Mm. And so he maps out a process that is basically take that imposter feeling that you have and write down all the things that you don't know anything about, all the places that you feel stupid, all the things that a real expert would know, but since you're a faker, you don't know, right? List all of those things out and then assign a medium, a content medium that you like to use to that subject. So for example, if you say, you know, I really feel like somebody who'd be good at this would know something about how to write better, for example. So adding stories, for example, to your writing in a way that's accessible. I have spent hours on YouTube watching Irish storytellers to try to learn how to do this better because I have felt incredibly insecure about it. But his point is write it down, decide, okay, I feel comfortable doing public speaking. In 2 months, I'm going to have a talk, a public talk, in which I talk about the fundamentals of storytelling, right?
So you put a target out and you hold yourself accountable to it sort of internally and externally so that you can essentially force your way into becoming more adept at it or more comfortable with it. And in that way can become not just an expert, but also sort of force yourself to find the ability to make that content.
That's right. That thing that you mentioned before of I need that death threat, essentially.
Right.
I need something in the background that makes me do it. Baker's point is that in setting those deadlines and in using a content medium that you like, you will put a deadline on the thing and you'll go do it, right? And in the doing, you learn way more from teaching than you do from studying. In the doing, you put that out into the world. And then the more difficult part is in expertise, there's a peer review process, right? Other people will come to you.
Right.
And some people will be jerks. Some people will just say, that's stupid. And you have to have that ability to detach yourself from your work product, right? Which is really hard to do.
Especially for ADHD people who may right. or may not have some emotional dysregulation or shame or whatever.
Absolutely. So you have to have that ability to see it as a getting to know process, not the scientific method. It is not you as a person. And it is really tough. It's really difficult. But I will say, when you look through my writing and the things that I've created or conference talks that I've given or whatever, most of the time, to be honest with you, the reason I talked about that thing is because I didn't feel really great about it, right? I created a deadline by which I could make myself explore that thing and feel really great about it. And now at 41, I am able to bring a voice to the issues that plague the legal industry and solo lawyers specifically, because that's who I take responsibility for.
Right.
Which is an aside, is a really fundamental thing too, I think, in dealing with the issues of ADHD. You want to own some responsibility for a group of people.
I love that turn of phrase. That's a group of people that I take responsibility for.
Yeah, because it detaches it from you a little bit, right? It makes it so it's not about you. It's about what you contribute and how you show care. And all of a sudden, all of those other social measures that we have about money or what you've published and when or what car you drive, all those measures sort of melt away because people will tell you, I mean, people have told me that they love me, like literally. Solo lawyers that I have cried in front of. I hosted a conference in Austin for 5 years called Lawyer Forward.
Yep.
And I would get made fun of consistently every year because I would stand up in front of this group and I would tell them, I care so deeply what happens to you. I love you. I want you to be okay. And I would cry every time and I'd get made fun of every time. But the number of people who would come up to me after those moments and say that they love me, that they see me and that they would hug me and say, thank you. That's what happens when you accept responsibility for the care of others. And when you do that on these deadlines, that imposter syndrome sort of melts away because you've turned it into a process and you can focus on the care. And that's what I've tried to do.
I love that. Another example of how that vulnerability has proven itself to be a superpower in building community for you because you've put it into action. So you also, you've said this, and this has been true since law school for you, but talking about taking responsibility for a group, and it's sort of these small and solo lawyers, and you're not just saying it, you're not just blogging it, you're writing a book. So tell me about lawyering in the Star Trek economy. Tell me about book touring through Texas in October. We'll put show notes in to make sure that you know how to find Mike on his tour through Texas to talk about lawyering in the Star Trek economy. Tell me how this book helps you take responsibility for your people.
Please don't write a book. Okay, so do write a book. It is a fantastic exercise, but it is honestly the most emotionally grueling thing that I've ever done. And even, by the way, the book initially was called Lawyering in the Star Trek Economy because it is all about this connection and this analogy. I ended up going with the title Lawyer Forward because...
Oh, you did. I apologize.
No. You're not wrong to... In fact, I wonder if the website still has the old title on there, but I realized that that effort of finding your place in the future of law has more to do with others and your connection to others than it does to you. At some point, I realized emotionally that we are actually quite limited as individuals, that our ability to have impact, I think as people with ADHD, we have a tendency to take a lot of things on ourselves. It's weird because for me anyway, that history of not fitting in to a group, whether it was a class or a job or whatever, I just frankly do not fit into structures like that very well. Never have. I've referred to myself as unmanageable, which the people who manage me at Casetext can probably attest to.
Unmanageable.
But when I shifted from feeling like I have to fit in all the time to realizing that, holy crap, I have real artistry if I just be myself, right? If I can be myself loudly, that is a contribution to the system. And the way that I maximize that contribution to the system is to connect with others. And so the book ended up being that kind of activity. I wanted to tell the story of this idea of the legal supply chain, of this human connection that becomes a business model. And initially, it was super nerdy, and it was just, here's what logistics is, and here's a bunch of books on the strategic supply chain, and nobody cares, right?
Right.
Nobody but me wants to read that stuff. And what I ended up doing was going back and rewriting it with my own personal journey of discovery as the narrative framework. So the story now is a narrative of a first day that shocked me, in which I saw an older lawyer on his own, really broken down, barely surviving. And I remember telling my wife that day, I can't do this anymore. I need to find where I'm supposed to be in the law. And a several year trek of discovery that made no sense while I was doing it, but in retrospect looks genius. By the way, that's what happens when you do that getting to know process. Everyone in the future will say, holy crap, your plan was awesome. Tell me more. And you're going to feel tempted to say, oh yeah, sure. I had a plan. You never had a plan. It's okay. You just made it up as you went. It always makes sense in retrospect. And that was my exercise as a side note. That lawyer that shocked me in the beginning, that made me realize that wasn't the way I wanted to practice, that wasn't the way I wanted to live. While I was writing the book, and I don't share this in the book because it would sound like I knew it was coming or it was gratuitous. While I was writing that book, that lawyer committed suicide. And it wasn't because he didn't know what the legal supply chain was, right? That would be a little too on the nose.
Right.
But when the hurricane hit Rockport, which is where I was living at the time, Hurricane Harvey made landfall in Rockport, that gentleman didn't have the financial reserve to push through that because he was just churning cases. He was just running. He was identifying his value in the churn, in that next hour, not as an asset or as a person or a member of a community. It was just that next hour, right? And
yes.
He didn't have the emotional reserve to deal with that difficulty because he really was so alone. And so I tell that to say that when I mentioned to you before we got on the call that the life expectancy for people with ADHD is actually 8 years lower than the life expectancy of someone in a similar situation.
Yeah, it's shocking.
And largely, it is because of these emotional burdens that we take on. If we get diabetes, we're less likely to be able to take care of ourselves. We're more likely to have depression. We're more likely to be alcoholic. We're more likely to engage in these addictive behaviors. So when we talk about ADHD, you and I, it's easy to see it as, boy, I have a hard time paying attention in class. That's not what it is. What it really is there are several systems in our lives that are almost designed to isolate us, especially if we are a lawyer. And the solution to that, which is better for clients, it's better for you, it's better for society, is to build these networks through this open vulnerability to fill in the gaps, to recognize what they are, and to work through a process. So that was a lot of words, but that's what the book is. It's showing you how to, through networks, through connections, through your open humanity, how to fill in for what makes you feel insecure and to do better for everyone with it.
Well, and I think we talk a lot about margin here. So Sean Block and there are others that have talked a lot about margin and how important it is. And folks with ADHD struggle in particular with margin because most of their lives can feel reactive. It feels like you're never doing anything proactively. You're never buying yourself time or space, financial margin, emotional margin, literally time margin. And what becomes challenging to do is figuring out how to do that while, if you're a smaller solo running a business, if you are right. a big firm lawyer, billing and keeping the bosses happy, if you're not in the legal industry itself, but adjacent to it, it's making sure that you can keep your priorities straight. And so one of the goals that we've identified at JDHD is I want to help create 1 million worry-free nights and weekends, right? And it goes to this idea that you as a lawyer cannot have worry-free nights and weekends if you haven't built in that margin, if you haven't taken the steps that you need to find that space financially, emotionally, with your time, with your project management. And that's why I'm really excited to read Lawyer 4, because thinking about the legal supply chain as such and figuring out how we fit in there and where we can create margin within that framework, I think is really powerful. And the other thing that I wanted to say was, when you talk about that older gentleman who didn't have any margin and the consequence of that, it harkens back to another quote of yours that I really love and hate. It resonated with me. Maybe because we don't know how to make being a lawyer work, or maybe because we don't think we deserve for it to work. That's the struggle. For me, it was the latter. I've accepted for too long that I can't run a practice the way I want, that misery is just inherent in the business and I need to get over it. And I think what your book talks about, and certainly what we talk about here, is the idea that misery is not inherent in our business, but it does not happen unintentionally that margin comes your way or that you create space to be happy or to have worry-free nights and weekends or to build the practice that you love or to be on a journey like yours where you maybe aren't practicing anymore, but you've evolved into someone who supports other lawyers and things of that sort. So I just love the way that you talk about it. And I love Lawyer Forward. I never made it to the conference, but I was always following on Twitter because everyone was live tweeting it. So I felt like I was there, but I never was. So I'm excited for the book. I can't wait.
Yeah. And I will, on that point, just a little secret that I would tell anyone that's looking at this and thinking through the system of the way we practice, which is focused on the next hour. In the book, it's the bad guy. It's the capital C churn. Yep. It's this idea that you're only worth your next hour or your next document or whatever, and that every minute your value is reset, right?
Yep.
That is tailor-made to make people with ADHD feel like crap about themselves because yep. it is exactly what we are bad at,
yep.
right?
It will prey on you. That's right.
And in the book, my large business model type argument is instead of focusing on cash flow, focus on assets, focus on things that you can create that provide more permanent value. One, because no one else is creating assets, right? Everybody else is just doing the churn. And if you can build things like a book or like a course or like a business or whatever, you know, your network of people that you use that can solve problems, that's a strategic asset. Whatever it is, you're trying to create permanent value that brings results even if you're not pushing the button. Because as you mentioned, as someone with ADHD, you're not good at pushing the button all the time. Stop building a business that demands that.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. And I also think it's a great transition into the third segment here. I really want to talk about tips for JDHDs, right? What thoughts do you have? What experiences do you have that we can distill down to help folks who maybe they know they have it or maybe they don't, but we've described some feelings and some thoughts and the way that it feels to be undiagnosed with ADHD or diagnosed for that matter. What tips do you have? If you were to do this all over, if you had someone in the room with you, what would you tell them about how to be a lawyer who also has ADHD? Give us the goods.
Sure.
You're a law firm coach and you've used one. Tell us what you'd tell us.
So the first thing I would say is that if you're a sole owner, the only thing consistent about your business is you, right? So if you keep building an environment that is made for someone else, a business model that is designed for a person that you are not, you are going to feel friction all the time.
Yes.
So the first thing I would say is just recognize that you're it, right? You need to take ownership. I mean, there's the Dan Pink book, Free Agent Nation. Even if you're a practicing attorney practicing in a firm, just the way the model is set up, you're still on your own, right? And the way the modern economy is set up, you're still it. You are the one consistent thing about your career. So detach yourself from the advice that comes in and contextualize it for you. Don't let people tell you you have to do X to be a lawyer, because it's not true and it's not really mindful of who you are. So that's the first thing.
So what does that look like? What's something that you maybe did to build your practice that was built for you instead of someone else?
Right. So one thing, for example, that I was told was to give free consultations, for example. And I enjoyed giving consultations. I liked the conversation side. It was the very human side.
Probably felt a little shame about how much value
right.
you would have to charge someone to give all of that insight and brilliance and experience.
That's right. And largely because I felt like it wasn't that insightful or that brilliant. And so I could sit and it was free. And so I could be lawyerish and not feel bad because I'm charging you for it. After a while, I realized that I could turn that into a product with a deliverable, right? Seth Godin has this thing where he says, charge as much as you have to keep the promises that you made. And so I analyzed the promise that I was making with a consultation, which was that I would give them a path forward. That's really the end result that people wanted out of that. And so then I started charging for consultations. I would call them a divorce strategy session. And what I would do is, instead of just them paying me to sit and pontificate for an hour, which sure. is pretty useless, what I would do is I would take that interview. There were some documents beforehand. I would take the substance of that. I would actually pay someone on lawclerk.legal to create a brief, essentially a document that would say, here are the issues that we're going to look out for. And then, so they would walk out with a deliverable. They would walk out with an actual product that if they never hired me, their lives would still improve. And so one of the things that I had to do that this specific example is relevant to is realize that if I felt insecure about my value, stop making it about me and start making it about the deliverable and make sure that I charged enough to deliver that thing well.
Sure. I like that. You talked about lawclerk.legal and, you know, Hire and Esquires and other. There are probably 7 or 8 of them out there. I'll leave a link in the show notes to LawClerk. But essentially the outsourcing of tasks that you're either not good at or don't leverage your highest and best use and things like that. I understand you've done a little bit of work with virtual assistants as well along the same vein.
Oh yeah, I could not survive without a virtual assistant. To be clear, hiring a virtual assistant is one of the weirder experiences that I've ever had. It's really hard to not build your own inefficiencies into someone else.
Yeah.
If you hire a virtual assistant and they're supposed to be an extension of you, you're going to do one of two things, and I've done both of them. One is you're going to expect them to be you. You're going to want them to be creative and thoughtful, and you're looking for this valve that you can kind of put things off to. Usually when you're hiring a virtual assistant, that's not how it works. You really need to train that person. But what I realize after a while is that I can send the tasks that I'm never going to get done, right?
Yep.
By accepting who I was and what I'm good at and what I'm not good at and sourcing that stuff out. And I'll say, if you are going to do the work of the legal supply chain, the supply chain generally has four disciplines. It's design, source, build, and deliver. Yep. And those are the four things you really need to know. That second one, source, that is the work of somebody who's in logistics. And what they're always doing is saying, I recognize that there are 100 steps across this process. It doesn't have to be me in each spot because I'm probably not the optimal person.
Yep.
And just like with that toaster, if you assign each thing to the optimal person, not the cheapest person, not you, the optimal person, the toaster actually becomes cheaper. It's the weirdest thing because you've added all these layers of complexity, but it actually makes the toaster cheaper and better.
Right. My wife is a lawyer for a major corporation here in Minneapolis. And at one point they had a trip they were taking to reward their salespeople. And she needed to find the best cruise ship lawyer on the planet. And she found him and his rate was absolutely astronomical.
Sure.
And she was blown away and she had to engage him anyway because, you know,
well, what am I going to do?
Right.
Right. And the value that I'm sure he provided in limited hours was way beyond anything they could have researched and done.
Well, and that's the point, right? I mean, she could have hired random commercial firm in town who would have looked through this contract and spent hours and hours and hours doing legal research and blah, blah, blah. And maybe their rate was only $400 an hour. I mean, only quote unquote, only. This guy's rate was more than twice that,
right?
But he got on two phone calls and the thing was done.
Oh, sure.
That was it. So it literally doesn't matter what his billable hour rate was because the value that he provided by being optimized for the thing that he wanted to do and was best at actually made it cheaper. So I think that's a brilliant point about virtual assistants.
And this gets to the next tip I would give. Imagine the insecurity that comes from the alternative, which is you go buy a book from the ABA's publishing department. It's 200 pages for $100.
And $200.
$200 for a 100-page book. And you read a third of it. And then you're supposed to give some kind of informed answer. This faking like we know everything thing create so much insecurity, and it's consistent with these ADHD symptoms. So
sure. Then you feel bad for the amount that you are billing.
Absolutely.
So you're aware of it. So you write it down before it even gets to them. And by the time it gets to the client, A, you probably shouldn't have been doing the work in the first place. B, to the extent you did do it, you probably learned it well enough to provide good counsel, but it might not have been a good investment for you. And it certainly wasn't reflective of the value that you provided them or the value they were expecting you to give.
Absolutely. And so the next tip relevant to that that I would give that's consistent with what we've talked about is you have to realize that you are not on your own and you are not your work. This thing that we do, that we associate shame with the things that we didn't accomplish, we tend to try as people with ADHD to tackle the fact that we didn't accomplish something. And I don't think that's the activity that's going to be the most helpful, right?
Right. Especially if we're trying to tackle it perfectly.
Right. And to be clear, I was diagnosed with ADHD in law school. They gave me Adderall. I took it right before a test and then I never took it again because even though it kept me on task, it made me not creative at all. And I'm not saying that people should drop off medicine if they need it. What I'm saying is there's a trade-off, right? There are superpowers that you might have that rather than chasing them away, it's better to optimize for them. And part of the way to do that is to recognize the difference between a to-do list and a shame mechanism, right?
Mm.
Optimize as much as you can and adapt for you as much as you can, but also realize that you probably need a therapist as much as you do a calendar, right? There's really no reason to do this stuff alone because you've got to address that identity piece, right? The piece that says, I'm not okay. I'm not worth it. Get a therapist because you've got to address that foundational issue before any to-do list will solve things for you.
Yeah. I love therapy. I also have a coach, an ADHD coach for that purpose. And I think that on the therapy side, we spend a fair amount of time talking about shame and using cognitive behavioral therapy to kind of talk through that and give me some tools to power my way through what my wife calls the itty bitty shitty committee and figure out ways to disband the committee, at least for today. And then the coach, on the other hand, gives productivity tips and helps me. He's sort of externalizing my executive function, which is one of the fundamental definitions of ADHD is executive function disorder. So I couldn't agree more on that. And then the other thing that I know that you've goofed around with, and I don't know if you still do this, but gamified task management. When you have tasks to get done, do you use tools or apps or tricks or scripts in your mind to gamify that at all and work through it?
Well, to keep it as fundamental as one can, I'm a big fan of using the Kanban board.
Okay.
A Kanban board is essentially just a wall with post-it notes that you create categories that as you get things done, you move them along. The gamification element of that is the victory you feel, and studies have shown that you feel this victory when you move the post-it note past the not done pile to the done pile, right? Gamification is really just spinning off of that emotion, that dopamine rush that we get that makes us feel like we've got to keep chasing, right? Dopamine is different than serotonin. It doesn't provide happiness. It gives us the feeling that we've got to do the next thing. And ADHD people are addicted to dopamine. It's why we scroll up on our phones. It's why we play games for long periods of time. So instead of fighting that dopamine rush, I would encourage you to find ways to gamify the stuff that you do. So you get the dopamine rush anyway, but in a productive way. So, and there are plenty of apps that do this. The Habitica, which used to be called Habit RPG.
Yep.
It is formatted like a role player game. Again, I happen to like board games, and figuring out that money is just a board game and not an indication of my worth as a human being was
I love that.
Major move for me. But Habitica is really good for that feeling that makes you feel really good when you, okay, when you scroll up through Twitter like I do and you read all this stuff, you keep scrolling and then you feel like crap about yourself, right?
Yep.
It's those two hormones, the dopamine and the serotonin. Gamifying your tasks gets you both of those emotions.
Right. Yeah. So it's a healthier way to get your dopamine fixed than maybe some other unproductive activity.
Yeah. So Habitica is fun to play with, but even post-it notes on a wall, you can turn that into a game and reward yourself and get that same feeling if you don't want to get into slaying dragons while you're filling out briefs and motions.
Right. I know we have a mutual adoration for a woman called Angela Duckworth, and she once said something about the problem with human beings is that they're human beings and they repeatedly make decisions that undermine their well-being.
Right.
Even if they know full well that it's not a great thing. What is one thing that you repeatedly do, even though you know that it maybe isn't the best for you?
Hamburgers.
Oh, probably. I love hamburgers. Yeah.
You know, I make this analogy all the time. The toughest thing, I think, with coping with ADHD, but just life in general, is that eating a hamburger doesn't make you fat, and not eating a hamburger doesn't make you skinny, right?
Right.
It's the cumulative effect of habits. I think that the hardest thing for me to do that I wish I would stop doing is I'm an emotional eater. And I probably screwed up my blood sugar so bad now that it really doesn't matter what I eat. It'll just turn into whatever it is that's trying to kill me. But again, people with ADHD tend to have addictive behaviors. The thing that we would do as an aside when I was in Italy on my mission, we tried to get people to quit smoking. And the way that we would do it was this plan that's centered on grapefruit juice. Basically, we would tell people, you know, you have that moment where in your mouth you think you need to smoke. You've got that taste in your mouth that makes you feel like you need to smoke. Replace it with grapefruit juice because it's disgusting and it will shock you and it tastes nothing like cigarettes.
Whoa.
You like grapefruit juice?
I can accept the premise of your argument, but that's ridiculous.
You're a monster. You are an emotional terrorist. I don't understand the value of grapefruit juice.
Italians, at least when I was there, when I was wooing my wife back in, I don't know, it was probably 2009, love the cigs. Big fan of the cigs.
They do. And they drink Sambiter, which is like this nasty drink. It's bitter, this totally nasty drink. So I would probably smoke after drinking that too. But they've got pear juice, like nectar of pear. Guys, we've got better options. Anyway, I would tell people, drink the thing that shocks you out of that habit. So one tip broadly that I would give you is, whatever that thing is, that's that repeated addictive behavior that's not giving you the result that you want, find some way that will shock you out of the pattern that precedes it, right?
Mm.
Charles Duhigg wrote a book called The Power of Habit that talks about this as well. Habits are a circle. They're not a line, right? And if you can find the thing that predates the bad behavior, the thing that you're trying to end, instead of making that bad behavior your focus, you attack the thing that feeds it, right? So that's a good book. I would encourage reading that.
Yeah, and we'll leave that in the show notes too, Duhigg. And the other habits book that we talk about and will continue to talk about a lot is Atomic Habits.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've read it yet, but a little bit of a different approach to building new and healthier habits, but kind of with the same end in mind. All right, here's what I want to do, Mike. I want to ask you two questions, and I'm going to go, what do you think? Bad news first, good news first? Which one?
Let's go bad news.
You have a magic wand.
Mm-hmm.
You can wave it, and in a moment, one thing will disappear. What is the one part of your ADHD that you would like to annihilate forever?
Shame.
Yeah. All right, let's flip it. We're going to end on a great note. You have the same magic wand, and now you get to change the world. What is the one part of your ADHD that you wish everyone in the world had?
Creativity.
Yeah.
Just being willing to break things, right? I wish we had more people breaking things.
I love that. I can't tell you enough how thankful I am that you're here, Mike. I want to read one more thing that you wrote, and this one resonated, and there's a reason I saved it for the end. Wherever I meet you, online or at events or on a personal call, I hope you'll hear my sincerity. We're all making it up as we go, doing our best to do good in the world. I see you there, and I hope you never feel ignored. Mike, I never feel ignored when you're out there, and I hope the folks in our community never feel ignored. We see you. We are with you. We are in this together. And Mike, thank you so much. Please go find Mike at Mike Whalen Jr. on Twitter or at lawyerforward.com/bookupdates. Mike, thank you so much.
Thank you, brother. We'll see you guys out in the world.
You will. So that was Mike Whalen. I am a big fan of Mike Whalen. He has a ton of insight and a ton of beauty in the things that he has built in the world. And I just love his take. So read the book. Please get out there and get an idea of what it looks like to play to your strengths, to build a community around yourself, and to be vulnerable so that you and the world know how to make your life even better. Listen, I think that being yourself loudly is a critical part of ADHD. And I thank Mike for his vulnerability in that. And I thank all of you for your vulnerability in it too. I am so proud to be a part of this community and to talk like Mike. You are who I take responsibility for. Lawyers with ADHD are my people. I want to make a place where you can create a better business and a better life for yourself. Please reach out and tell me how to do that. You can talk to me on SpeakPipe like Amanda did. You can send me an email. You can comment on the website. You can do a whole bunch of things. And I'm thankful that you're here. I'm thankful you're part of my community. And I'm thankful that when I'm vulnerable and I share with you that all is not rosy, that you inevitably come to my aid and give me perspective in my life that is so deeply meaningful to me. Thank you. You all help make ADHD easier. This law thing, it's hard enough. See you next week.
Thank you for sharing your attention so generously. The single best thing you can do to support the JDHD podcast and this community is to help spread the word far and wide. Please tell your friends and your firms about it. Subscribe, rate, and review us in your favorite podcatcher. And please join our email list at thejdhd.com/start. We can't wait until next time. Let's make ADHD easier. Law is hard enough.